You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. My apologies for having been off the air last week. There was a little mishap that prevented Write the Book from broadcasting. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Glenn Finland, author of Next Stop, a memoir of family, which is based on her May 2009 Washington Post magazine feature story about parenting an autistic child to adulthood and then learning to let go. Next Stop is published by Amy Einhorn Books, Putnam. And the book is a summer 2012 Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers pick. A former TV news reporter, Glenn Finland's freelance work has appeared in The Washington Post, Family Circle, Autism Speaks, Babble, American Magazine, Revolution, A Cup of Comfort, Special Needs Magazine, and the East Coast Women's Anthology. A featured autism advocate on NPR and CNN, she's also the author of The Inside of an Egg and co-author of Changing Places, A Kid's View of Shelter Living. She's the recipient of the Southeastern Writers Association Best Fiction Award and a noted writer from the 2005 and 2006 Boston Fiction Festivals. She received her MFA from American University in Washington, D.C., where she has taught writing. Glenn Finland is a fellow at the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts and at Casa Libre in Tucson. Next Stop is the universal story of how children grow up and parents learn to let go, no matter how difficult it may be for both of them. The summer David Finland was 21, he and his mother rode the Washington, D.C. Metro trains every day. The goal was that if David could learn the train lines, maybe David could get a job, and then maybe he could move out on his own. And then maybe his parents' marriage could get the jump start that it craved. Maybe. Next Stop is a candid portrait of a differently abled young man poised at the entry to adulthood. It recounts the complex relationship between a child with autism and his family as he steps out into the real world alone for the first time and how his autism affects everyone who loves him. When I spoke to Glenn Finland in June, I started by quoting a line from the book and asking her to talk about what it means. When you've met one autistic kid, you've met one autistic kid.
Well, the real lives of autistic young adults are very nuanced. And I'm hoping that people will start to see other young adults like my David as just a regular guy who has found a different way of being human. I think of, or I should say for you to think of autistic kids as snowflakes. Mm-hmm. David is my snowflake. They're all completely different, completely unique.
Just like any kid.
just like you and me, yeah.
Right.
But the point is that this generation of kids with autism is growing up, and they are going to take their lives in directions that are uncharted by most of us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's time to change the conversation away from blessing and blaming and turn our frustration or anger into really positive action that is going to help raise awareness in the workforce especially, for this population.
Okay, great. Glenn, how did you decide to write Next Stop? How did you decide to write a book about David's experience and your family's experience?
Well, there are really two answers to that. The first is that the seed kernel for the book was a magazine piece that I wrote for the Washington Post magazine, Sunday magazine, that came out on Mother's Day in 2009. And it was the point was I had spent the previous summer teaching my 21-year-old son, David, who is tall, dark, and autistic, to ride the Metro in Washington solo. And in the process, he taught me how to let him go. And the point was, the hope was that if we could teach David to ride the Metro, to understand the train system, then maybe he could get himself to a job. If he could get himself to a job, he could get himself perhaps an apartment or make a friend, a social life, a life he could call his own.
Mm-hmm.
The other real question that I think you're asking me is, why would I want to write about this? And I had to think long and hard. I had to ask permission from all the principals in the story, which meant I had to go to David's older brothers and say, can I have your permission to write about this story? Because the story of autism is never about a single child. It's all about the family who loves him.
Mm-hmm.
And siblings are very conflicted. They experience feelings of love and duty and embarrassment and guilt, all these things, while they're typical, my sons are typical testosterone-soaked boys, you know. They're teenage boys going through their own high school dilemmas and traumas and dramas, yet they're also having to deal with something different at home. So I had to respect that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
With my oldest boy, I asked him what he thought, and he said, sure, let's see. It was almost a challenge. Let's see if you can do this, Mom. My middle son, who is the protective one in the family, said, on two conditions, that you don't embarrass David and you don't make his life any more difficult than it already is.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was fair.
Yeah.
And my husband said, yes, as long as you highlight his physical strengths in equal parts to his intellectual disabilities. David is a runner. He runs like a deer.
Mm-hmm.
And that opened up the entire story for me, because all of a sudden we were moving forward.
Right, yeah. And you mentioned that in the afterword of the book, your conversation with your family and Max and Eric. I thought it was wonderful, and a wonderful part of the story, their involvement in David's maturation and you know, just your family life. I'm wondering, now that the book is finished, how did each of those people react to the final product?
Well, Max is in law school. He hasn't had time to read the book yet.
He's too busy.
which makes sense to me. Eric has been terrific. He's a musician, a working musician, and he wrote the music for the book trailer that I did, and he called it David's Song.
Oh.
So if you go on my website and watch the little trailer, listen to the music. That's Eric.
Okay. How did each of them respond to, or actually Max hasn't read it yet, but how did your husband and Eric respond to your depiction of each of them?
Well, I think they had to just agree that we had to let history be history, and they were aware that I did not whitewash the truth, because this is no fairy tale. This mm-hmm. is me looking you in the eye saying, this really happened. So they didn't complain. I think they just realized that memoir writing is one's own truth. And, you know, if they want to see it differently, then this is the book that they can write.
Yeah, right. Well, that actually reminds me of something I was going to ask you about that takes place maybe a little bit later in the book than the beginning. But I loved you're writing about your reaction to holiday letters. Can I read a little quote from the book?
Sure.
You wrote, "What I couldn't control was the dreaded Christmas letters choking our mailbox, starting the day after Thanksgiving, that ignoble tradition of notifying one's personal listserv of how exceptional one's offspring are based on the milestones that camouflage the dysfunction in every family's life." And then you go on and you say, "It's not the self-congratulating spin that rankles, it's the missing truth." And actually, what you're saying about writing memoir, you know, you had to be very honest. You had to be very truthful. You could not pretend that it was something other than what it was.
Well, I've always sort of laughed and wept at a quote that I recall from John Updike. He said, "Marriage is a clash of two dysfunctional families." I love the honesty there,
mm-hmm.
and I've never forgotten it. And I try and honor that, but do it with humor too.
Yeah, I'm wondering, the people around you, let's say the people that are sending you these Christmas letters that choke your mailbox, do you think some people are more honest with you and your family than they might be with someone else, because they understand that your life is, you know, requires being very real?
You wouldn't believe the monsters under the bed that are coming out from people that I know well, or absolute strangers who just sort of sit down next to me and go, "Woo, now I can tell the truth." Hey, it's parenting. All parenting is difficult.
Yes.
All parenting is difficult. It's the hardest thing any of us will ever do. But the stressors are different for parents of children who have autism. I mean, it's the physical, emotional fatigue, the sheer watchfulness of it all, 24/7, 365 days a year for the rest of your life type of concerns.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we all want to give our kids roots and wings. That's very important. But when you have a special needs child, you are hardwired to protect. And it's hard to let go of a child's dependence on your dependence on him. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all wrapped together very tightly.
Yeah. You mentioned how hard it is being a parent at all, and particularly of a child that's differently abled, as you mm-hmm. say in the book. But, you know, marriage is also hard. Just being married without even having children is hard. And having children makes marriage harder. And then I would think having a differently abled child is even more so. So I wonder if you have any advice for parents who are coping with some of the same issues that you've faced.
Well, aside from throwing eggs at the side of your house.
Which I loved.
That has been a terrific therapy moment in my life. but, yeah, it is. It can certainly fray the edges of even the strongest marriage. It's the financial worries for the future. It is the anxiety from knowing we're not going to live forever. My husband Bruce and I are 35 years older than our son David. So the question that I have, that we have, that all people who are responsible for and love someone with autism is, who is going to be there when I am no longer there?
Mm-hmm.
What about this growing isolation that surrounds someone with a social communication disorder? But there are some good resources out there. So what I'm saying is, don't be discouraged. Be inspired to act. You can. Autism Speaks is a wonderful resource, a daily resource for me. First thing I do in the morning is check the blog there and see what's happening in that world. But you can also fight this growing isolation that can help tear up a marriage by bringing in help. And you don't have to be a wealthy person to do it. You can look to other family members and friends, babysitters, teenage mentors, community support groups, and then professional help if you can afford it. But what I always tell mothers is, do the unthinkable, and that is to salt away some time for yourself.
Mm.
Simple things. Pay attention to your diet and exercise. Try to get a good night's sleep, whatever it takes to refresh the well again, because if mama's not happy, nobody's happy.
Right.
And it might be the best gift you can give your family.
Okay. Glenn, this is a line from early in the book. You write, "We families get that instead of seeing autistic adults as targets for therapy, we must commit to a society in which they have equal access to jobs and the skills to succeed with the support and legal rights they deserve. But we also get that expecting empathy for those who lack it is a tough sell." That really made me think.
Well, I think what you're talking about is a general lack of public awareness and general support in the community and even by federal lawmakers. I'm hoping that one of the takeaways from my book will be to help raise awareness, as I say, in the workforce and in the broader community, that can help bring autistic people into the fold. And one of the ways we do that is something that a way that I changed by living with my son David for the last 24 years is you start by becoming a noticer.
Mm-hmm.
When you see someone with, say, the lack of eye contact or the missed social cues or the wrong body language, the impulsivity, the flat affect or the nervous ticking, consider that instead of just being rude or appearing to behave inappropriately, this person might be somewhere on the autism spectrum mm-hmm. and really inherently challenged by social expectations. They live a different life. So use concrete language to communicate back and forth.
I'm wondering if this might be a good time for you to read an excerpt from Next Stop.
Well, you know, the title of the book has a couple of meanings. Next Stop. Really, the question is, what happens next
mm-hmm.
when these young adults age out, special education students age out of public school and free vocational training programs in this country at age 22? So for many of these young adults, there is no next stop after that. So I'm going to read you a short piece called A Shiver of Recognition, just a page or two about the day that David graduated.
Okay, great.
June has arrived, and here is David sitting on stage in the second row of folding chairs. He's among 27 other special needs young adults poised to graduate from the county's job training program. With his 20 years in special education coming to a close, 10 of them in private school, the other half in public, here's what educating our David has taught us. We should have kept our son in public school and our money in our wallet as long as possible, because we will need it for what happens next, because what happens next is the rest of his life. And here is David up on that stage, dressed in his father's suit and with an ear full of shaving cream. I might have cleaned that ear for him, but tonight he invoked the 2-foot rule, keep your hands off me. An ear full of shaving cream is just the sort of thing I'm working hard to let go of. As we make our way to our seats, I am surprised at the strong turnout for the graduation ceremony. Even so, my husband Bruce and I are the only ones here for David. Our next speaker, says the principal, but that is all it takes to bring up David's classmate, Waheed. Waheed leaps from his seat with a heartbreaking smile, exuberant old-world manners, and a king-size suit on his slender frame. He races to the podium and shakes the principal's hand with both of his. His dark eyes are shining, and as he turns and bows to the spectators, he beats a fist against his heart. Waheed hasn't spoken the first word, and Bruce is already a goner. In a brightly lilted accent that reminds us he has traveled a very long road to get here, Waheed begins to thank every vocational training teacher, every counselor, each school cafeteria worker and building custodian he knows for getting him to where he is today, a restaurant greeter with a local hotel chain. With benefits, he says, zigzagging over the podium. And we are charmed, pulling for him in the long journey ahead, wanting to believe Waheed is one of the few who will actually make it. Then from out of nowhere, still at the podium, Waheed deviates from his prepared text and bursts into a sing-song riff of Yankee Doodle went to town riding on a pony. To this, he steps back from the podium and adds a neat little dance step. The audience freezes in a shiver of recognition, sliding its collective eyes right and left. We parents get used to these charming departures, autism's little non sequiturs, in the privacy of our homes and cars, but, oh, Lord, why here and why at this particular moment? Mostly the rest of us are relieved, quietly thinking it could have just as easily been my kid up there taking the detour, until one by one, Waheed's three sisters rise up in their dark hijabs and swirling skirts, and they begin to clap, deliberate and hard, in complete allegiance to their brother's happiness, their chins lifted in a show of support as indelible as blood. And so we all join in. At first, it is only polite applause until gradually we see there is more to this than Yankee Doodle Dandy. And we are rising to our feet in an ovation that swells into a wave of sustained cheers and whistles that come not just for Waheed, whose arms are now raised high over his head with his fists punching the sky, but for all of our kids on that stage, pushing, shoving, wanting, hoping. And here is David, so different from the others as he walks across the stage with his ear on his shoulder, yet so like them in his prospects for the future. Bruce and I are a corresponding flotsam in this sea of parents tonight, all of us mired in the sheer eternalness of it, working our jaws to keep our emotions intact. But here we are. We are here to bear witness to these young adults, hoping mightily that this night will not be the very best night of the rest of their lives.
Mm. Thank you so much. That was Glenn Finland reading from Next Stop, A Memoir of Family, and that's published by Amy Einhorn Books, which is a Putnam imprint. Thank you so much for reading that.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that section of the book. And, you know, just if we can talk about being a writer for a minute here, just, you know, the little things that you include in your narrative. I mean, obviously, as a memoir, this is very close to your heart, but just the little details, you know, that shaving cream in his ear, which is great because, you know, that makes us all be sitting right in that audience watching our own kid, you know.
Yeah, and you can smell it.
Yeah, exactly.
You can always smell a teenage boy.
So anyway, I just loved it. It was wonderful. And then the other thing I would mention about that excerpt is the financial reality of raising a differently abled child. And it sounds like your advice is that people take advantage of their public school systems if they have good public school systems.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was a psychiatrist who told us to pull David out of the expensive private school, and I said, well, you mean next year? And he said, no, next week. Mm. He said, save every nickel and dime that you can because you're going to need it. That was the best advice I ever received from a physician, I must say.
Yeah, okay. At one point in the narrative, you recount a story where you and David were separated on the subway platform. And you had to use the word retarded to explain David to a person who had the power to help you or to not help you with a difficult situation. He was not seeing that you needed to get through the turnstile to help this adult. And it was very painful for you to have to use that word because this person didn't understand. So I guess my question is, do you think that as time goes by, that person might understand the word autistic better? You know, do you think the vocabulary is changing yet?
Well, I think there's this whole movement toward what's called people-first language, so that you say, instead of an autistic son, you say a son who has autism. First it's the person, then it's the condition.
Mm-hmm.
But I have sort of a different take on the word autism or autistic, because I don't think it's the latest version of the word, of the R word. I think we ought to retake that word. I think we ought to use it, bust it wide open, and I don't think it's a verbal weapon. I think it's sort of a diagnostic catch-all, because autism is such a broad spectrum. If we can make people realize that there's so many different types of people who have autism, then when you see someone who is nonverbal and you see someone who is on the Asperger's end of things, you realize all of this is part of the spectrum. So I think we have to be very careful with words, but not too careful with words.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And not give them the power to paralyze the conversation.
Yes, exactly.
Well, you mentioned earlier, I think you mentioned as in reference to you're getting through some difficult times, throwing eggs.
Yes.
And that's a wonderful part of the book. In a couple different spots, you talk about throwing eggs as having been something that your mother did when she was angry, and she taught you that this was something you could do to express your anger when you needed to get it out. And then you bring that to David as well. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about throwing eggs, but also about your decision to include your own family history in the story of your family.
Well, I'll tell you, my mother is 97 years old, and she has lived a long, tough life, and she's pretty much the hero of my book in many ways, because she was one of the first special education teachers in Atlanta, which is where I grew up, and she was at my high school. So I saw her teaching a population that hadn't even been included in my high school up until she came in and started the program. She actually started a model program quietly, but she stayed with it. But I did catch her several times when I was growing up. She was widowed at age 43, so she was a single mom, and she did it all. But we just didn't have money for any sort of therapist or help. Besides, she was a social worker early on, so she kind of knew how to take care of her own. But I did catch her outside throwing eggs when my brother got sent to Vietnam. That was tough for her, and that's kind of the way she dealt with her worry. Mm-hmm. And she gave me some eggs once and said for me to throw them. And I have done that my whole life. I've had David throw a few recently. There's a real nasty goo, yellow goo, right outside the window where I write. And it's growing all the time. Try it.
I'm gonna totally try it.
I did a book club chat in Richmond this past week, and when I got there, someone said, I meant to bring a dozen eggs. I thought we could all go out and throw them.
That's great.
I think I'll bring my own next time.
I think it's a perfect thing. Just such a wonderful image of using your emotions, you know, and also, you know, for David, who maybe doesn't express his emotions like everybody else, to have the eggs.
The real sense of letting go, yeah. When that egg splats.
Yeah. Let's see. Well, you tell so many stories in the book, and one of them that just really got me was the incident where he ended up in a car with a stranger that he met on the internet, which is, of course, every parent's nightmare in the first place. But for a child who doesn't pick up on social cues, it's even more terrifying. So I just wondered if you could talk about that moment, and then also how you followed up that moment with David. Were you able to explain to him why that was not a safe thing, or do you think that he wouldn't be able to understand?
Well, one of the difficulties with David is his sort of mind blindness, just poor social skills, and the fact that he's quite vulnerable to some part of the population who might prey on an individual like David, and he is a loner. It's difficult for him to understand the difference between a friend and a poacher.
Mm-hmm.
So to explain things like that, I just have to use, as I say, very concrete language and just say, no strangers, no strangers. And it was a miserable moment. It was a miserable long couple of hours, actually. Mm-hmm. But it turned out well. And a lot of times we just, Bruce and I, just look at each other and say, nothing bad happened, and keep moving forward.
Right, right. The other thing that occurred to me in reading that section of the book was that David did call you, and he shared what was happening, and he kept you on the phone. He didn't hang up on you. And it made me think that there was an awareness on his part that this was not okay, or this was not normal, or something
was
going on.
What you don't know is that I'm on the other end saying, don't you hang up that phone. You still there?
Okay. Well, talking about protecting him, let's talk a little bit about Max and Eric and their relationship with David through the years. I know that's a huge question. You know, let's talk about the whole lifetime of these two boys with their brother. But can you maybe just address siblings in this family?
Well, as I say, Eric is protective. He's brother. He's the one in the middle, and I think he's the one who looks for balance. And many times during the high school years when we could hardly even talk to each other, I would find Eric the next morning in David's bed with his arms wrapped around his little brother.
Mm.
It's just something that he has always done without being overtly verbal about it. And since the older brothers have grown into young men and left the nest and gone their own way, they have both turned to me and said, you know, we will be there for David in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I do believe that now. So that's, I wasn't sure there for a while because they had to work out their own teenage angst, and now I know that they are there.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different raising what is called a neurotypical teenager compared to a differently abled teen. So it's I have to pay attention to all those differences. Just when they leave the nest, it's just a little bit tougher.
Yeah, right. I would think too. There's a challenge in a family with a differently abled child of giving everyone the love and attention that they need, and particularly that there are two kids in this family who don't necessarily seem to need extra attention, and David, of course, did. Can you talk a little bit about that?
There's no question that siblings of special needs children get neglected. I certainly am guilty, have been guilty of that in the past, and I became very aware of it as I was writing the book. The squeaky wheel gets the grease. Yeah. And my neurotypical kids could pretty much fend for themselves. I think it made them stronger. They have told me that they feel like that they they are more responsible. They can figure out ways of getting around their own personal challenges. But there's no question that I was not there for them at very critical moments of their growing up years, because I was at the doctor with David, or at a therapist, or trying to figure out how to get Social Security worked out, or going through the mounds and mounds of paperwork, or just sitting at the kitchen table counting nickels and dimes with him for his math lesson. Just hours of it.
Yeah. Although, you know, if you think about the different generations and how different generations have raised their children, and of course everybody now is so hands-on all the time, but, you know, kids can handle a little more independence than we give them.
So. I think so, too. I've always kind of just pulled back from the idea of a helicopter mother.
Yeah.
I was what you call a latchkey kid, and I was completely happy, you know? I loved having to pull that key out from under the rock on the bottom step and walking into an empty house. For me, it was freedom.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, your mentioning the key reminds me of something I wanted to ask that I haven't yet, which is the cover of the book, which is a great cover. It shows a pair of sneakers, I think, sort of at the edge of a subway platform. Is that right?
Thank you for that question. That's one of the happiest things that happened with this book. After it was finished, I had nothing to do with the cover that showed up on my email one day from the graphics people at Penguin. And here was a pair of pristine white tennis shoes instead of the dirty ones that are there on the cover on the edge of the metro platform.
Right.
And I'm looking at it, and David walks by my computer, and I said, "Dave, what's wrong with this picture?" And he said, "The shoes need to be dirtier, Mom." And he walked out of the room. And I just went, ah, perfect. And I ran into his closet, and I threw out all the shoes and leftover T-shirts and wet towels and dirty socks, and until I could find in the bottom the shoes that he wore in the Marine Corps marathon. And there they were. There was a key laced through the shoelaces. And I wrapped them up, and I FedExed them to New York, and I said, "I don't care if I ever see this pair of shoes again, but you've got to give it to the artist. It's got to be these shoes." And they turned it around for me a week later.
That's wonderful. And there is the key still sitting there.
There is the key.
So. I love that. I just thought that was great.
Yeah.
And it's a car key, right?
Yes, because, you know, he ran the race, and he had his little old Jeep that got him there, and then he had to hold on to it, and he doesn't like things touching his skin, so he put it through there. I guess a lot of runners do that with their keys.
Yeah. And he does, his grandmother taught him how to drive.
Absolutely, when he was about 12 years old, on a tiny little island where she lives off the coast of Georgia.
Well, David does eventually find work in a few different situations in the book. I loved that in one of them, actually I found this on your blog, Glenn, but I loved that you were invited into David's workplace to talk about the best way employers can interact with adults who are on the autism spectrum. And I wanted to talk to you about that. Do you think more employers are becoming this enlightened as time goes by?
Well, it's going to be slow. It's going to be a long time coming. I think the company that brought him in was really the first employer that David has had who has taken an interest in his autism per se. So I was quite thrilled to be able to go in and just do sort of a workshop with ways that managers can focus on the employees with autism and start to understand. One of the things that I told them was prepare to have your feathers ruffled and
right.
then learn how to shake it off, because it's not about you. You can't take it personally. You just have to let it go. This sounds much easier to do time after time than it actually is. But, you know, it's little things like, could you get the door for me, David, instead of just watching the door being slammed in your face? You know, now hold it until I get all the way through. That's it. You know, little things like that. Little things. You just need to lighten up, because everyone benefits from a good sense of humor.
Yeah.
There was one day I found out after wrapping up David's first week of work, he came upon his supervisor in a parking lot and said, I'm off the clock now, so you can't boss me around. The supervisor was initially shocked at David's comment, but fortunately he had a sense of humor. And he didn't exactly understand it, but somehow he got it. And he diffused the situation with a good-natured belly laugh.
Mm-hmm. And he told you that story later, or did David tell you?
He told me much later. No, I would never hear such a story from David.
No, okay.
Yeah.
I was wondering, so you mentioned already in our conversation a few tips that you share with people, one of which is to use very concrete language. Mm-hmm. And then you just said, you know, your feathers might get ruffled. You have to kind of like let that go. I wondered if we could talk about the 2-foot rule, which was another tip that you shared when you went into the workplace to talk to people.
Well, the 2-foot rule really means give him room to breathe, and providing 2 feet of personal space around someone with autism may be paramount for his peace of mind.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't add stress to a situation by imposing your physical self into the conversation. Many people with autism are tactily defensive with acutely heightened senses, and really quite uncomfortable when stuck in small spaces or being subjected to loud noises. So a handshake is fine, but you don't want to poke or hug. I know my son would react to that like he'd been snake bit. So
mm-hmm.
just make a standard handshake part of your daily routine so that he knows it's coming and doesn't perceive it as an assault.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. I just thought of something that I hadn't planned to ask you, but I'm wondering, you know, have you ever found yourself emulating David's outlook on life in order to behave a little bit less emotionally than you perhaps, you know, you don't want to be oversensitive, or you don't want to be over emotional. Do you ever think about, well, what would David do in this situation?
I tell you who does is my husband, Bruce. A lot of times I'll be worrying myself sick, saying, oh, he must be so lonely. He must be so by himself all the time. He must want. And my husband says, let's turn it on the flip side. That's what you think he wants. That's not what he wants.
Uh-huh.
So leave it alone. Back off.
Yeah.
Let him be who he is.
Yeah. Great. As a writer, Glenn, I'm wondering what other writers have influenced you, or who are some of your favorite authors?
Well, recently, I guess in the last year, I was really taken by Julian Barnes' The Sense of an Ending. Just the beauty of the language and the timeless prose. Just somehow it reminded me of Beryl Markham's West with a Night, which is another favorite book of mine.
Okay.
But over the years, I have to say that a very important book to me as a writing teacher and as a writer myself has been, and this might surprise you, Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carry.
Oh, beautiful book.
I know it's a war story about a place I've never been to, but I am so drawn to how O'Brien deals in ambiguity, the gray areas where there's no clear right or wrong, no moral clarity, only what is the right now of the moment. And he's someone who doesn't whitewash the truth, and he understands how messy our lives get, and he has the courage to let history be history.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm curious if have you ever discussed that book with your brother?
My brother doesn't talk about Vietnam
at
all.
Yeah. So how about now? Are you reading anything right now that?
Well, I'm always reading things. Right now I'm reading Joe Blair's book, By the Iowa Sea. He has, it's a memoir, and I'm enjoying it, but I look around my house, and the books are just sort of pulling off. I mean, from the sort of bend towards you from the weight of the bookshelves, you know. So they're, I come from a family of women who are always reading. I'm in the kitchen, in the yard, and in the car, and my grandmother called us book swallowers, and my oldest son Max is a book swallower, someone who just inhales the written word. So that's fun. And always penciling in notes on the pages. I'm not one of those who says, you know, keep your book clean. I say, mark it up. If you love it, mark it up. Dog ear it.
Right.
So you can find it again.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned a little while ago that you teach. So are you teaching right now, or are you taking a little time
I've been taking a break just to finish the book.
Right. And I'll just mention that we met at a conference, a writing conference last year, and that part of that writing conference was a workshop situation. So I have a question for you for writers, and particularly for writers of memoir whose subjects might be particularly difficult or painful. Do you have advice for those authors when they participate in writing workshops?
Well, I would say always write from a place of love. If you're writing about yourself, a memoir is not the place to extract revenge. I mean, that isn't writing, that's complaining. So I think we also have to consider how much true stretching can be tolerated in a memoir, mm-hmm. and what's kosher. So I always say that you can embellish with dialogue or setting or the senses. You mentioned shaving cream. and you can also collapse time and reorder sequential events to make them work in service to the story, as long as you don't change the truth's intent. And that's critical.
That's critical. And how about when you get into the workshop and you're sharing your work and people are commenting on your personal story? Have you ever had a hard time with that? Or?
Well, I think it takes a lot of courage to write anything. And maybe the best advice that I got is to write about the thing that you're afraid to write about.
Mm-hmm.
Because that will tell you what you're trying so hard not to say, and that's what's keeping you from putting it down on paper. You know that bony finger that taps on your shoulder saying, no, you cannot write about that.
Mm-hmm.
Write about that. That's the thing.
Okay, great. So I guess my last question for you, Glenn, is how is David doing?
Well, it's two steps forward and one step back. He right now he has a job. It's his fourth season working at the Washington Nationals baseball park. He's a ticket taker there, and of course that season will work. It'll be over, and he'll be job hunting again in October.
Okay.
So we were at an interview yesterday, and he fell asleep during it. So.
So do you go into an interview with him?
I sure do. I just try to stay mom, but sometimes I'm like, I try.
And where does he live now?
He lives with us still.
Okay. Well, I very much enjoyed speaking with you. The book is Next Stop, A Memoir of Family, Glenn Finland. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
I enjoyed it so much, Sheila. Thank you for having me.
That, once again, was a conversation with Glenn Finland. You can read more about her work at glennfinland.com and at her publisher's website, us.penguingroup.com. Today's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Glenn Finland. Describe the precise moment at a time in your life when you realized you had to let go of someone or something, and what gave you the courage to do it. Good luck with this prompt, and tune in next week for another. Write the Book has a Facebook page. If you're a Facebook user, please like us. And if you're interested in sharing the show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. As always, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, or if you have a writing prompt to suggest, or if you'd like to request that I try to get in touch with a favorite author to see if I can interview that person about a new book, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.